Lend Me Your Ears, the Oral Dramaturgies Podcast. The Gallery, interviews with artists.
Hello and welcome to The Gallery. Dead Center Theatre Company resists categorization in every way. It was founded by two British friends, Bush McCarzel and Ben Kidd, in Ireland, and was immediately propelled to international fame. Their first piece, Souvenir, inspired by Marcel Proust, but written, as the programme informs us, with Theodor Adorno, Walter Benjamin, T.S. Eliot, William Shakespeare, Don DeLillo, Charlie Kaufman and Orson Welles, was shown to great acclaim in New York, Brisbane and Seoul soon after its Dublin debut in 2012. The following year, they premiered Lippy, a piece inspired by a real-life event of a suicide pact involving four Irish women in the year 2000. Dead Center's rendition of this story was delivered in a highly lyrical and distinctly Beckettian stage language. Their interest in authorship, adaptation, and the unique potentials of the medium of theatre were crystallized further in Chekhov's first play in 2015. This was an adaptation of Chekhov's Platonov, commissioned by Battersea Arts Centre in London and using headphones. In addition to these multi-award-winning works, Dead Center have also made Shakespeare's last play at the Schaubühne in Berlin and the interpretation of Dreams at the Burgtheater in Vienna, as well as Hamnet and Beckett's Room in Dublin. Like Chekhov's first play, many of these works include audience participation, while Beckett's Room requires full imaginative investment as the entire piece takes place on an animated set with audible but invisible characters. Amid the COVID-19 pandemic, the company made To Be a Machine version 1.0, co-produced and premiered as part of the Dublin Theatre Festival as a live stream with a digitally configured audience. In this conversation, we explore the formative influences, the developmental journey and the central concerns of Dead Center as a company, getting closer to their behind-the-scenes process, interest in technology and working methodology. This conversation took place on Zoom between London and Dublin on the 27th of May 2020. Just at the beginning of the conversation, while we were waiting for you, Ben, I was asking Bush, how come you're both from London, but the company ended up in Ireland? So maybe we can start with that. We often start these conversations by retracing people's footsteps. So how you met, how you started working together, how you found this shared interest in speech and sound as sort of the main component of your work, and maybe also what formative influences determined this choice as well.
We met as friends, I suppose, at university in the UK, quite a sort of naive theatre society, doing plays, acting, performing, and all that sort of stuff. We then both graduated and left university. I trained as an actor in the UK, in Bristol, and then I tried to work as an actor for, not for too long actually, a couple of years, I guess. I tried to give it a go with a very little, which is to say effectively no success of any kind, really. And then sort of started to try and move into directing through a fairly tried and tested, I guess, method that I'd picked up in the UK's kind of very still, perhaps not so much anymore, but still at that time, sort of mid-2000s, still very ad hoc, in the best possible use of the word, amateurish kind of directing ecology. Traditionally speaking, posh white men came down from Oxford or Cambridge and had some drinks with some friends of theirs, and all of a sudden had a show on at the National. You know, that was the kind of, it's much less the case now, but there wasn't anything like a sort of formal, you know, to compare it with what little I know about cultures like German theatre culture, you know, there isn't that same directing training that's in place. Like I said, it's changed a little bit. So anyway, I was kind of floating around doing that and testing out my abilities and ideas, I suppose, and trying to get work as best I could, and assisted here or there, and got a few pieces off the ground and entered competitions. And at the same time, Bush had, very surprisingly to everyone who knew him, mutual friends, gone to Ireland. And I let him take over kind of why and what happened there. We kept in touch as just socially, really, and with a kind of shared interest in discussing what theatre was about and what was interesting and what was going on and what was piquing our interest and what wasn't. And then an opportunity came, as these things often do, an opportunity came that was quite ad hoc and quite contingent. Just Bush decided to start making a show and needed someone to help him. He was going to be in it. And he was going to be the only person in it, so he needed help and make sure the lights were pointing in the right direction, basically. And so he got in touch with me about going over to Dublin to help to direct that show, basically, which is a piece that he'd written. That was a piece called Souvenir, which was our first piece and which was produced in the Dublin Fringe Festival, the first of two pieces that we made in the Dublin Fringe Festival. And this is where, I guess, I'll hand over to Bush for the rest of the story a little bit, because this is where Dublin as a place and as a ecology of making work and of generating work at a small scale and a community of theatre makers kind of steps into. I still live in the UK. I've never lived in Dublin, and so I still perhaps see it from an outsider's perspective and perhaps see it slightly more favourably. I don't know, maybe not, but I certainly would count it as a very significant element in our development and how we managed to develop.
Can I just rewind a little bit? I am actually interested in what you studied at university and what that university was, even though it feels like it wasn't that significant, but I'm just interested in hearing a bit more about that.
We were at Nottingham, the University of Nottingham, and I studied English with philosophy. And Bush, you studied some philosophy and film, or philosophy and American studies?
That's it, film.
Yeah. Okay, and then how did you end up in Dublin, Bush? I think that's the question.
Well, firstly, when Ben said we were met at Nottingham, he said we were friends, I suppose. And I got to pick up on that.
As opposed to colleagues.
No, I think maybe the reason why he has to frame it like that is actually we met in the Drama Society and he was playing Hamlet and I was playing Rosencrantz. So you see, this is the rivalry was there from the start. You know, I was looking up
going, this is really
one day I'll be able to.
This is really embarrassing to say, but
we've
had this conversation before, and it was actually Guildenstern.
It was Guildenstern.
I don't know why I remember that, and Bush doesn't, but it was a different small part.
Well, you see, you had your eye on the little people. That's why, right? That's why I guess we were able to have common ground. But so and there were some things that we were interested in then, and writers. And on the one hand, that theatre society was quite traditional. At the other hand, it had people like Mike Longhurst running the Donmar now, Carrie Cracknell, Ruth Wilson. There was a kind of a large amount, Joe Arkley, who does a lot of established actor, a group of people who were actually now have made their careers in theatre. There was an energy there. Even if there wasn't a great experimental energy, there was a sort of a passion for it, which is why we were screwing up our degrees while pursuing, you know, theatre on the side.
It's probably fair to say, Bush, that you were exercising some of the experimental tastes in some direction back then when you were making... all I was doing was acting in plays when someone told me I could have lots of lines to say.
No, I just mean we weren't... The conversations, we didn't know about a sort of international avant-garde that was not involved in the conversations we were having. We didn't really know about experimental theatre. It was more just the literary works. Hopefully the more interesting reaches of that in British theatre, Sarah Kane and Mark Ravenhill and Beckett and in Irish theatre. So we were looking at, hopefully, you know, sort of curious writers, people testing the limits of writing, and Carol Churchill. But we weren't looking at the international performance avant-garde or thinking of theatre in a wider context that the kids tend to do these days, it seems, when you see what the student theatre companies are up to. But so, anyway, yeah, I moved to Ireland to study psychoanalysis. I was doing a master's degree here, because Trinity College in Dublin offered a taught master's in Lacanian psychoanalysis, which I had wanted to pursue, having found myself, like everybody, reading Slavoj Žižek and wanting to unpack why this seemed to be a fruitful tool for cultural and political analysis, the Lacanian system. That led me to Lacanian psychoanalysis, which led me to Dublin, with a flourishing interest in Beckett as well, and trying to understand what had been the ground for his work. Where had he come from? What was in the water in Dublin that led somebody to be so despairing as Beckett? how did he see the end? And he just wrote through it all and just finished it. And I still think he's got a checkmated narrative. I still think nobody has quite, somebody will come and propose a better paradigm, but it's sort of his checkmated narrative. I still think we're stuck in a Burkettian, in the way we might still be in Einstein's models. We're still in the Burkettian model and we need to overcome it somehow, which will probably happen in the digital age. Increasingly, there'll be the poet of the digital age will kind of articulate better the world we live in now. But anyway, that took me to Dublin and I studied here working as an actor and with a company called Pan Pan, who are quite established in Ireland and on the international scene. And they were known as the sort of the whole Irish avant-garde in theatre was Pan Pan. It's not true. There was few companies, but there's a small enough scene here. And Pan Pan certainly were the only ones who had that international reach and were on the international festival circuit. And so I got a sort of a great education under the director, Gavin Quinn, acting in about four of their pieces. Sometimes I stepped into all other pieces I made with the company as a former creator. But also then going on tour, you would then see Richard Maxwell or the Sukumira. So we kind of open our eyes to all the possibilities and widening sense of what theatre is and what it could be. And that was what I was cutting my teeth in as an actor over about a 3-4 year period in Dublin, all the while going, like everybody should do, I can do this better. I obviously knew I couldn't. You know, mine will just be another damn show, which somebody else will then look at and go, I can do better. And then they'll do just another damn show. And somebody, and that's fine. And that's the catalyst. And that's how it works. So as long as you can leaven it with a little bit of irony or a little bit of sort of skepticism, so you don't become an arrogant prick, you kind of go, I can do this. With that sort of burgeoning aspiration and ambition to kind of take what I've had learned and try to form something of my own, I thought of a solo show, obviously within the means, there being no budget, based on Proust and the ambition, which is sort of still what we carried forward into our work still, is trying to adapt something which on the face of it seems unadaptable. Do something which shouldn't fit, and then you meditate on the discrepancies or whatever. So trying to adapt the longest book ever written to a 1-hour fringe show, but while using questioning performance and work put and using different strategies to tell it in an unusual way. So that was where I found myself and then got the advice to get a director, because if I was going to perform this, as Ben called it, pointing the lights in the right direction, that
which
was what
I'm sure necessarily ever came to pass, in fact, if I think what would, the lighting in that show. Yeah, I think there were definitely.
Yeah, we lit the space direction beside me. Yeah, yeah.
And what was that piece called?
Souvenir.
Souvenir, that's the piece, yeah. You mentioned in Licky.
That's the piece, well. Exactly. And as Ben said, yes, in truth, the idea was, okay, get my mate Ben from London, what has been doing a bit of directing, so I hear, to come and point the lights in the right direction. But then we actually found we had more to explore than that. We worked closely on the text together that I had prepared for rehearsals, but through rehearsals we sort of scrutinized it and co-adapted it together. And we were co-directing, even though I was performing in that. We were sort of forming a working model. We were certainly trying for it to conceive it around a total theater where all the elements were totally relevant to us. So how sound was going to operate in it, how the audience becomes activated in it and not just passive viewers, how the style of character as a character I might be playing can be broken and interspersed with my biography and things like that. We were trying then to break the mold a little bit in what could be otherwise seen as a traditional one-man narrative show.
You mentioned Beckett and your interest in Beckett that kind of predated the existence of the company. Could you look into that a little bit more in terms of like, what were your respective encounters with Beckett? Because Beckett, it seems to me it features in some unspoken way in Lippi, but also obviously explicitly in Beckett's Room, which is one of your more recent pieces. I don't know whether I'm right in thinking that interest in the Beckettian worldview, if you like, is in some way foundational for your company as well.
maybe by doing Beckett's Room, it was probably a mistake to sort of touch the kryptonite, you know? Mm-hmm. So maybe actually that's the least successful or the least mm-hmm. Beckettian of the pieces. Mm-hmm. But for me, certainly, it came out of, I mean, speaking of us both doing philosophy degrees, mm-hmm. it became a way in which a playwright was moving the conversation forward within philosophy and the way performance and the way the body can answer questions or sort of make philosophical propositions or it just suddenly brought theatre into the argument directly. So when I first saw it, was actually probably around 16 or 15 or 16 when I saw Endgame, and the kind of scenario and the language seemed to just be so extraordinary and so different, this blueprint of all plays. And it just seemed to be a general problem that you had to sort of engage with and overcome, his worldview, this vision, if you could. And then moving to Dublin again, it kind of goes to the source of the kryptonite, and it's he's shot through everything here, Beckett's language and also then that economy of language and minimalism in theatre and a certain discipline of writing. The influence is vast. And then on the other side of it, the innovation between it. So you have the philosophical gesture of his writing and thinking, and then his work as a practitioner. He was just an innovator. You know, his writing is at once set design, sound design, or whatever it might be. It's a sort of a total in integrating all the elements in the one gesture. So you can't separate the stage from his writing. They all speak, all the elements speak to each other. And that integrative style was very formative as well. Every element, it has to be a Jenga block. You can't remove one bit. If you do, it should all fall down because they have to all sit together, you know. So that was another way in which he was an influence.
Yeah. That last point seems very potent, though. There was not a writer before, and although I'm sure there have been lots and lots since, who quite thought through. In almost every stage piece that I know that he wrote, there is that complete, I'm not sure if integrative is a word, but it's a good one. It's not just that he's concerned with all those different elements, which is in itself a very impressive thing, but that they are all being used to make meaning, and they all seem completely fundamental. I think there's another thing as well that I've always felt about Samuel Beckett, and my relationship with him has not been as, I don't know what the word is, apostolic or whatever, as Bush's has over the years, and also my knowledge of his work isn't as deep. But the other thing that strikes one, alongside this remarkable concern for form and this remarkable experimentation in trying to get to the bare bones, which is probably a Beckett phrase, I don't know, of what is meant by a theatre act, you know, in a very overt sense in Beckett's work. If you look at the way his theatre experimentation went in his later works, there's a very overt concern with almost a sort of philosophically reductive idea of what can we reduce this down to and still call it a theatre act, and what does it mean that we can make such a reduction? What does that mean about what we're all gathered here to do? But the other thing, you can't just reduce him to that, because the other thing is the line-by-line writing and the way in which text is used and the very specific way in which characterization is used seems to me to be still unassailable.
But to pick up on your point, on your point there about the reduction process, and that is, and to connect and to get out of Beckett, look, because is what I mean. We can go on, you know, it becomes an obsession, you know, and making Beckett's Room was an attempt to put a full stop on it, but let's see. You know. the reduction leads itself to where we're at now, you know, with everybody making work in this new environment and trying to see, can theatre survive this restructuring? Is it necessarily a live event with bodies? Can it be transposed into a digital format without losing its essence? And all these questions will abound. It's basically leading going, can you just have a mouth on stage? But yes, I think you can. You know, it's the similar drive now, which is, I suppose, what will be the new environment of here, people searching to see what will be a theatre act.
How did Lippi come about then? What was your sort of process of conceiving that piece and then working on it? I'm asking about Lippi specifically because I read Beckett into it, and I don't know whether or not I'm correct to do.
Yeah, well, the giant mouth is an homage to Not I, of course. Mm-hmm. But the practicalities of how that came about, the background to how we developed it, I mentioned that we'd been given some space by the Fringe to develop a show. So we used that in collaboration with Adam Welsh, who was our sound designer over those two shows, Souvenir and Lippi. He actually performs in Lippi as the technician as well. And I'd had a picture of a post-show talk. So really that was a sort of a way into a show. And was sort of unrelated to this real life event. That was a separate thing I'd been looking into. So it was a formal setup. Could you start a show as a post-show talk and as a way into a discussion? I had this idea about a lip reader being interviewed. It was actually going to be mostly about lip reading the extras in the background of movie scenes. And it was all about that, like the incidental narrative that you don't quite see. It didn't quite work out. But that was the sort of formal invitation to a show. And then I had again in mind that while he was speaking at the end, you'd do the mic drop out, kind of a classic trick, but it works every time. So it's always seductive and a joyful gag, but it has this emotional resonance of a dislocation and a disembodying of the voice. And so that was the idea. And that when that happened, you would move into a new place. I had sort of the shape of that. And then on the side, living in Dublin, I'd come across this tragic story of the Leakslip family, the Mulroonies, and the inexplicability of a kind of tragic private act like that. And it became clear that we couldn't really speak directly to their story, but you could meditate on the telling of a story that isn't yours to tell. And that suddenly spoke to a voice, putting a voice in a mouth or a voice leaving a mouth, and all the structure and all those kind of the imagery surrounding that. And also the using playwriting or scrutinizing playwriting as always the putting of words in somebody's mouth and the ethics around that.
Is it an intervention in the ways in which verbatim theater had been made up until? I mean, that was very illuminating what you just said, and I read in the program note that you explicitly framed it as a piece about authorship. But to what extent were you also engaging with these methodologies of making verbatim theater that were quite dominant in the early 2000s, maybe some years before you made this piece?
Asking that question was interesting because I don't think we were thinking about that work really, certainly not in any sort of attempt to engage with a critical discussion or anything like that. I think people's responses to the piece sometimes did situate it in a lineage of work that engaged with the real, I suppose, engaged with restaging the real. And whilst, of course, that's what the piece is kind of about, it was strangely, I think, the lineage of how a playwright would approach this, you know, how a creative writer would approach it.
I'm sorry.
To pick up on what Ben's saying there, it wasn't a conscious decision to play against things we'd seen or certain strategies of storytelling. But of course, in line with that is, yeah, you're dealing with reality, you have a real event, and you want to sort of find ways to approach that. And I suppose maybe different from verbatim theatre, which is attempting to honour, capture and honour the event almost as transparently as possible by having the language being only recordings of people from the real event. I suppose, like Ben used the word the real, and more to use my Lacanian background here, we were approaching the event that had happened of this starvation pact as the real, rather than as reality that we had to somehow tell the story of, but as the real that couldn't be told, that was a sort of a kernel of unrepresentability that refused to be shown and refused to be appropriated into narrative and meaning. And this is where we get back to Beckett a little bit about how a theater can meditate on meaninglessness. So it doesn't have to be a meaning machine. Most of culture operates as a meaning machine, and it sort of takes the raw material of our life and fashions it into various coherent straight shapes that we can digest and engage with. And theater can always engage with meaninglessness and go back to a point before that appropriation happens. And you're sort of staring then at, in Lacanian terms, it's called the real. That was our sort of way, different from verbatim, perhaps, to sort of an anti-verbatim a meditation. But with great sympathy to the strategies involved in that. It's not scoffing at narrative. I don't think there's really a way out of it, but you can sort of frame it and talk about it. So the way playwriting was used, we build it as Lippi by Dead Center with cameo playwright Mark O'Halloran. Mark's name is quite established here in Ireland, a little increasingly internationally as well. He's established screen and theatre writer and performer. And so by framing him as a cameo playwright, he wrote the monologue at the end of the play. It was trying to frame the project of playwriting as one of imposing a meaning, a necessary imposition of meaning to give it a structure and a shape.
I'm alone. I'm the last left. I wish I were dead. I want to be dead. I will be soon. I'm being tested. Why am I being tested? Black. No return. Nothing. I keep speaking to this darkness. It stays me from sleep. I don't want to sleep. Those dreams, that room. My sister's gone. France is gone. Those carcasses. Their hair like women's hair and their teeth. I'll go mad. Or am mad already. Who's to tell?
What I found interesting about the process of making that show was that for all that, as Bush has explained there is a kind of coherent and quite rigorous kind of philosophical investigation being pursued. At the same time, one of the things that we thought about quite a lot, and one of the things that I found difficult and compromising in terms of my instincts, I guess, when making that show, was that Bush pushed for, and we gradually figured out, a language of work whereby an event in a piece, an object on a stage, can have its own resonance and can be found in the mind through, you know, as David Lynch talks about the big fish, if you meditate more deeply, you will find the bigger fish in the deeper oceans. And it can just have only a tangential and quite ephemeral relationship with what your thesis, or your, in traditional terms, your narrative, your story is doing. And yet it can still be allowed to live in a piece, and then it can be allowed to make its own waves throughout the piece. I think a really obvious example in that piece is there's a sequence with a leaf blower that blows paper on the stage, and that was just a sort of an idea, I think, that Bush had, kind of sui generis, as it were. And then the task became, how on earth do we fit that in? You know, and there was a lot of that kind of thinking I found quite hard to assimilate, in a sense. It's quite a nerve-wracking way to make work, and it's not a way to make work that I'd been hugely versed in. I'm not trying to make value judgments about any particular different type of style of work, because the simple fact is different approaches lead to different types of work, and there's lots of wonderful work in the world and it's all different, you know. But nevertheless, there is a sort of way that directors in my culture have traditionally been trained, and I think kind of trained in some sort of semi-formal senses going through buildings like the Royal Court, whereby everything serves a kind of pre-existent narrative drive, let's say, or indeed just a dramaturgical drive. It doesn't have to be a narrative drive. But one has to really hold one's nerve when one goes, you know what, there's just going to be a leaf blower in it. And then you have to hold your nerve and see where the waves take you, and then reassess and rebuild your house afterwards once you've allowed for this thing.
Traditionally, a leaf blower, and using that image inside the show, doesn't have a natural and organic place in the narrating the story of these women's death, and it could jar in a way and seem to be inappropriate or a bit of unanchored surrealism. Sort of working those images into it and seeing how they can have a home because they have intrinsic theatrical potency, and that's enough.
Talking of authorship then, very quickly, how does it work out in between the two of you in terms of making work? Because you're co-directing, Bush, you're writing scripts as well, you are also performing. What's the division of labor there, actually? What's the model of compatibility that you've found in how you actually make work together?
It's this one question comes through, and then we misunderstand, we only half hear it, and then we have to kind of find our way back. So actually, yeah, misreading and misunderstandings and Skype, because Skype is our medium, a big, you know, of talking between Dublin and London. So actually, frustrations with technology are sometimes when the plays come out in a fragmented way, we weren't trying to be experimental, we just didn't have a good enough Wi-Fi connection for the sentences, the paragraphs, to be coherent. So yeah, there's going to be so much accidental avant-garde after this, just because the glitches were not intended, but we read them as being intended. That's okay.
Yeah, I do wonder about those kind of questions, about the things that affect what one's work is like, that one isn't really always in control of. It struck me when you were saying just earlier about your observation about corporality being very central in theatre work for a certain while, and then maybe something about sound and voice and slippage coming. I'd never thought about that, but a brief bit of thinking about it, probably maybe agree. But I certainly remember when I sort of early noughties, mid noughties, when I sort of came out of drama school, people of my generation were all very, very interested in getting into a room and using each other's bodies and building stories out of bodies. I think we have a big problem and concern with text in British theatre work, and I would sort of extend that to Irish a little bit for the purpose of this conversation as well. The text and how we use it and what purpose it serves and how it works. I remember Bush saying when we started making the piece after Lippi, the Chekhov's first play piece, in one of our complicated Skype calls that kept cutting off and the frustration kept building and the voice kept becoming dislocated from the body or whatever, you know, a concern that Bush used to raise, and I hope you won't mind me repeating this, Bush, was like, I just can't understand why any of them would start talking. Because it was basically a sort of adaptation of a play is what we were doing there. And this kind of anxiety around how, for some reason, we located, or you located, was this anxiety around, it's sort of maybe acceptable to have a person on a stage, maybe, but for them to start opening their mouth and just kind of blathering away, what on earth would they say? Do you know what I mean? And that became, again, that was probably another example of something that I initially found kind of obscure to the point of perverse, maybe, in terms of like, what on earth are you talking about? But that, an attempt to try and answer that question, I'm not saying it was answered successfully by that piece or any of our pieces, but an attempt to try and answer that question and see, I guess it's to be lofty about it, it is to do with authority, I suppose, and also, you know, on what authority is someone speaking to a room of 200 people. It's also connected with kind of fiction and kind of inventing. So how on earth would someone say something that wasn't true? You know, why would you say something that just isn't true in front of an audience? What kind of weird bargain are you getting into when you're doing that?
Well, what we tend to do, and it kind of finds a different groove each project, we co-author and co-direct together. Lippi was an exception, and Souvenir, I suppose, where I had done the primary authorship. Mm-hmm. But from Chekhov's first play onwards, we kind of get going together from the ground up. The process tends to be, you know, we have a formative idea for what the show could be, or usually it's a gesture or image, and then you start unpacking from there. And we do that usually remotely over Skype, and a few sessions here or there in person. We go back and forth over the course of a year, usually developing a script, starting by sharing research and writing and notes and meditating on the ideas, and then building a script together, Google Docking it back and forth. Usually a live document, so we can sort of see how it's being changed. A tendency might be that I am sort of the author and Ben's the dramaturg. You know, I might put something out that he then pushes back, and then I put out and then he pushes something back in that way. But really what he's pushing back is authorship as well. So it's not just suggestions and notes, it's also rewriting a section or putting. So that's why it's co-authored. But it sort of follows that path until we get a script together. And then in the room, we division of labors again. I'm a bit louder, so I kind of do a lot more talking. And then when people don't understand something, they go to Ben, and then they usually come away and go, oh, that's okay, now I get it. You know, because then he sort of explains it a bit with a little less bombastic when I'm sort of trying to shout out to a whole room and you get charged up and a bit overexcited and you're not very clear. We run the rehearsal room together. So it's, the division of labor is sort of down the middle, you know. It's fine. Our characters obviously depend who we might pick up on a bit of conversation, or who leads one meeting, or what with which designer or something.
Mm. What was the like you say, you start with a gesture was the word you used. What was that initial gesture or kind of impulse for Chekhov's first play?
Another word we use a lot is equation. We say, what's the equation for the show? Again, it's a sort of arbitrary obsession, but it's a catalyst for writing. And I find that what is the first sentence, basically, is the equation into the evening. When Ben spoke earlier about me getting a lot of anxiety over people speaking on stage, I didn't understand why would they start talking? It just feels like, well, you're presuming so many things about that, you know what the deal is between the audience and the event. So I feel the equation has to be set up clearer in a way, so that then you can go anywhere, then you can do whatever you like, really. But it's just interesting that you just set up that first, it's like first impressions, you know, go a long way. And also, and Tim Crouch is probably a very useful reference for this kind of thing, you can problematize it and you can be lying in that equation. The equation doesn't have to be honest. In fact, the worst type of equations are the ones which are seemingly transparent, where a performer comes on and says, hi, good to meet you, thanks for coming this evening. And they really mean it. And they're just saying hi. And then they make their show. That's like a false equation. It's not real, you know? Whereas if you say hello, and then there's something, you're ready, the game is being played. A bit like I watched it 2 days ago, again, The Encounter by Simon McBurney, where those first 5 minutes where he seemingly off the cuff talking to the audience as he was waiting for the last audience to come in from the bar and set up. You know, every line is setting up a theme of the show and is delivering the kind of way in which he's going to tell this story. He puts all the elements on the table. By gesture or equation, these are words we use a little bit to find a way in. And because the one with Lippi had been so clear, this post-show talk, so the sentence, hello everyone, thanks for staying behind. There you go, you've now cast the audience. So the audience now know who they are. Oh, we're the people who stayed behind for a show that never happened. So they have a role to play within this event suddenly. And now you can play, again, you play, problematize that dynamic, move away from it, come back to it, whatever. But you've set up, you've made the audience feel seen in the modern, you know, as the modern parlance goes, they feel seen.
Yes, I was thinking about that also last night when I was watching it. I was thinking how it's really about starting from the here and now of theatrical performance, even though it's a kind of a fictional here and now, but it, you know, it kind of recognizes that basic convention of us being.
I think you want to do that and then problematize it. So you go, it's great, we're all here. And then you go through questioning, how are we really here? And in what way are we substantially here? So Hamnet we set everybody up. Oh, we're all here together. I don't know why. And then by the end, we cast the audience as dead. Like, they're all ghosts, really, you know? But to quickly answer this, and then we can go back. I know, Ben, you want to say something. But you asked, what is that gesture in Chekhov's first play? And what is that? Or what? And I was putting it as, what is that equation? Ben was saying we sort of struggled to find. But it actually started with going, again, this idea, which I'd mentioned with Souvenir, staging the unstageable or adapting the unadaptable. So we sort of come to this play. Ben had been interested in the text of what's known as Platonov for a long time, the untitled first play of Chekhov, as being this 7-hour, 8-hour document with scenes missing and have a sort of rough quality to it. And bringing that in a way that maintained its fractious nature was our interest, because we'd known about adaptations by, in the English tradition, Michael Frayn and Trevor Griffiths and other people who had adapted that play and smoothed the edges out. And made coherent plays out of that, trying to sneak it into the canon in the back door. You know, oh, this was actually just a proto Ivanov, and there it is. You know, yeah, it's a bit long, but it's actually, we can make it a pretty 2-hour Chekhov play that we can then perform at the National. Whereas actually, no, this is an unwieldy event that should be, we should preserve this problem. I've just been reading some, to talk pretentiously about philosophy for a while, I've been reading some of Adorno, and he's doing lectures on Kant, and he says that the most important bit in a philosophy is the bit that doesn't add up. The contradictions are the bit to preserve. So when you look at Kant and you go, oh, this inconsistency here, the academics will get rid of that to then teach Kant's system. Okay, this bit is wrong, obviously, it doesn't fit in, but here's, and you tidy up the edges and you teach that to people. Whereas Adorno says the insight is the bit where the philosopher's system doesn't work. That's where they've hit reality. You're finding there the fertile, what he is, negative dialectics, I guess, for Adorno, but this is the fertile problem between thinking and action, and that actually there's an active relationship there. But anyway, so talking about that with the Platonov script, we wanted to bring that to stage with its problematic status. So that was the first inspiration, and then the equation was this director's commentary, really. We found that through a little bit of wrong turns and workshopping it and trying out. But that was when we went, okay, that's our in. And that frames the event in a new way. And then, of course, it leads us into why we're talking here about what you can then do if you're taking sound seriously.
Yes, yes, indeed. We haven't actually talked about sound much yet. But Ben, do you want to corroborate on any of this?
Theatre seems to be quite unique in my mind as a form in that it can contain a mistake. It doesn't quite make sense to me as how a film could contain a mistake. It doesn't really seem so philosophically impossible because the people know, whereas it's possible for an actor to forget their lines, and that is a possible thing that could happen. And what I don't think it's necessarily been fundamental to us, but technology in theatre often also introduces another level. I mean, technology can be anything from a curtain moving to a microphone to a projector or whatever, but introduces another level of type of mistake. And there's something quite joyous about the mistake. And something quite profound about it, I think, about what that could be.
Because there's something that's, I think, always been quite exciting about, and I think the mistake is linked to the idea, I think you said actually, just kind of the fictional here and now. You know, that's exactly what, I agree that that idea of that line, hi everyone, thanks for staying behind, just was instinctively a good idea for a beginning of a show. I think the thing where Dan takes his, or where the lip reader character, sorry, takes his microphone down and carries on speaking, that's a kind of mistake in a way. I know it's not a mistake, but it is a kind of a questioning of, oh, hang on, is that working right? You know, I remember we did that show in Edinburgh, and about sort of 30 seconds after that happened, the computer died and the QLab file stopped playing, and we had to stop the show, and Bush had to come on stage and apologize. And of course, everybody who saw the show thought it was part of the show, because that's the kind of game that we were playing. So anyway, that was just something, that idea of the mistake. I don't know where I got that from, really, but it just came from what you were describing. I suppose connected as well thematically with the Chekhov play and the idea of not wanting to get rid of the mistake, but wanting to investigate it.
The anecdote he was giving there briefly at the end, it was our own fault, you know, like we could, you know, we deserved it. So we couldn't get out of this kind of prison we'd set up. Mm. Again, I was thinking about the encounter. It was so brilliant, but it's state of the art. I wonder why, because I imagine he was very interested. They didn't really play with mistake. It's like, I was watching that going, what was the creative team's anxiety every night? Is it just so rigorous that they go, no, this can't fail? Or were they like, what if that Sennheiser head just fails tonight? You know, or what if one wire gets kicked out when he's running along? Like, what's their backup system? This is all the stuff I was thinking about when I was doing Souvenir, which I was like, nothing. I'm just going, what do I do if that doesn't open tonight? And if that thing doesn't actually work when I pull it, so what shall I say? I just want to be ready for plan B and plan C.
I think also one of the things that our work tries to attain is a degree of precision as well. I don't think we're interested too much in kind of, there is chance in the work definitely, but if you try and attain that degree of precision, you can't escape its horrifying opposite, which is that things go horribly wrong.
That really cues up Beckett's room and the scope for anxiety there in terms of things potentially going wrong seems to someone like me who is just watching it enormous. You know, I mean, like, how do you deal with mistakes in that?
We didn't really get that far because we made that show and then it was set to tour this year. And then, so we didn't have many chances to go through the what if. That was what our rehearsal period was for with that show, is it was the technical and puppetry team really understanding their system and design. They designed it, obviously bespoke, and created a system which they understood. So they were kind of making it reliable. We had to imagine that the person firing Ableton, the sound program, would have to be like a concert pianist because she was there and having to watch the stage would be really reactive to, you know, there was a sort of through score of some things, but then there was her reacting to small movements that then she was triggering the sound design for. So, yeah, that was a very anxiety-inducing experience. And I think that it was to the detriment, because I think, but again, we didn't really do it enough. I would have learned more about that show this year, and I will learn more if we do get to bring it alive again. But in its short run, I think, yeah, the anxiety that the audience felt for that was not supposed to be so excessive. We didn't complement it in the way we have that anxiety in our Traumdeutung show in Burgtheater, where we bring an audience member on stage, a complete stranger each night. She lies on Freud's couch and she tells a dream. And then we interpret that dream live in the show. And it goes off into a very strange place. And it's a very complicated technical show. It's our most complicated show because obviously the Burgtheater has the resources to really take it somewhere. But in that case, the anxiety of will this work complements the dramatic event. Yes. And the audience are reading their experiences through the audience member who's seeing her dream recreated live in this way. So I think it's a complementary experience. Whereas in Beckett's room, the anxiety, I think, is pulls you away rather than brings you in.
That's very interesting. Very interesting. And is it? It's presumably performed in German. The Freud play.
Traumdeutung. Yes. So that just opened this year, and they were running the show successfully, and they were having good responses, and they've invited us back now. So they were very happy. So our next premiere will be in the Burgtheater in April next year, in theory.
To do what?
To do what's called The World is Everything That is the Case, which is a Wittgenstein, a project based on Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus. So it's a staging of the Tractatus.
Okay, another big challenge. So that's now triggering another set of questions for me, which is to do with the other languages in your work. Obviously, there is the question around how these international collaborations have come about, but also there is something in your work in Chekhov that, you know, there are sections in Russian in it, actors are speaking Russian, and then similarly in Beckett's room, other languages are in the mix. How does that come about, and what's the interest in language?
It depends. In Beckett's room, that was, I suppose, trying to capture a realism.
Yeah.
That's a naturalistic rendering of the story. Mm-hmm. And it would just be, and we just weren't satisfied with the sort of BBC, you do it all in English, but with French accents or something like that. We just weren't satisfied with that as an option. Yes. Yes. So that led to that. But then on a deeper level, it becomes a European prayer for this multilingual texture is our cultural and ambition. You know, it should be the case that we sort of celebrate and hear the world in that way. And so, and when you're not doing that, it's really giving up on something which is such a joyful path. You could do it all in English, but if you bring in all these other languages, you get a richer world, or the world. You're also known as the world. You bring the world in, you know?
And it potentially reads also as a way of resisting Brexit.
Again, in the case of Beckett's Room, that's what they were trying to fight for in that narrative, is to fight for Europe, you know, in that literally. Yeah. And then, you know, we were playing it at a time when there was a different type of fight for Europe. The collaborations we do there, those were international artists that we met. Two of the actors were from the Schaubühne that I'd met. Vivian de Moink, who did a lot of work with Need Company, I'd met her through Pan Pan as a mentor in one of the projects I was working on. So you sort of, it's also...
And Valentin as well.
And Valentin Dehens, an extraordinary actor. We met because he was in the dressing room before us in Edinburgh when we were doing Lippi. Right. He was doing Small Wars. So we met him and felt, you know, a great sympathy for him as a person, beautiful human being, but also a great artist. So that, you know, we'd always hoped to work together. And then he had recommended Laurence Wuthu, who he had worked with before. So that's why we cast her, met her and cast her. So it was really, you know, also a legacy of the international collaborations that we've done, is that you kind of meet so many interesting people in the way and want to bring them into the texture of the work and how it sounds and then feels. We have working knowledge of French, probably a bit better, and now increasingly in a working familiarity with German. And we spend a lot of time when the texts are translated with the translator or with the dramaturg, going line by line and really scrutinize what's going on in the German and try to unpack what we think that tone that we're achieving in the English line is.
Ah, there you are.
Here I am.
I see you.
And I see you.
Ah, fuck them. Let's stay in bed.
No one ever ringed that phone.
It'll stop in a moment. Any minute now.
I think you should answer.
If I can remember how to use it. Okay. I'm coming.
Allô, Monsieur Beckett?
C'est moi-même, je pense. Qui est-ce?
J'ai un message de Perron pour vous.
Alfie? C'est de Monsieur Perron?
C'est marqué Madame Perron.
De Madame Perron? Que dit le message?
Alfred arrêté par la Gestapo. Prière de faire le nécessaire pour corriger l'erreur.
Fuck. Oh, fuck.
Est-ce que vous avez un message à me donner en retour?
Tu lui diras que j'ai reçu le message.
Who was it?
A message from Mania.
What message?
Alfred arrested by Gestapo. Do what is necessary to correct mistake. What does she mean, correct mistake? How can I correct anything?
She thinks we could be next.
You're right.
Should we go?
Yes, let's go.
Actually, I want to ask several things, but you know, one thing is the audience is wearing headphones, which are not quite yet. It's not quite yet binaural sound, is it? It becomes binaural in Beckett's.
We would use elements of it. It wasn't totally binaural. Mm-hmm. Beckett's Room had been recorded exclusively in binaurally, but in Chekhov's first play, we had used a binaural recording for moments and for getting textures. It is just that sound is just not, it's one of the reasons why it's not so good in theatre, because the sound isn't good enough. If you're in a big auditorium and you're at the back, you're sort of uninvolved in a way. And when you go to the cinema and it's the state-of-the-art Dolby surround, and it's sort of such an awesome experience that you can be enveloped in. There's no reason why theatre shouldn't have that same sonic ambition. You know, of course, practically, it's not always achievable, and that's understandable, but it can aspire to that. And so the biggest problem with the headphone show was how to go back. After we made a headphone show, we're just so disappointed to not make every show on the head on a headphone. It's a relief because it's very complicated and brings a load of technical concerns and costs with it. But you can afford such intimate communication that it's a shame. So it's hard. So actually, since we made that headphone show, all our other shows, we've been trying to, can you achieve the same effects, but without headphones? It's using sound that's completely involved in such an involved way.
But what you're describing sounds like you're still sort of prioritizing the theater experience, which is then just served by this extra oral dimension that is possible through the headphones, rather than being driven by that interest in what that technology can do.
Maybe, but maybe I think together, it's all just in tandem, actually. Yes. Like I was saying at the beginning, you want to create a scenario where you can't remove one element.
Mm-hmm.
Like it wouldn't work.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, you know, I don't want to go to a show and it just be a sound experiment.
Right.
And I don't want to go to a show and it just be a design experiment, a visual design.
Yeah.
You want to go and know why every element is there and we speak to each other and harmonize. You want to have a complete sort of a total experience in that way. Of course, it doesn't mean there can be a show where you sit in darkness and have an aural experience, but actually the darkness is the set design there, you know. So there's been a very considered set design, just so happens to be complete pitch black, which is very hard to achieve.
One thing I would say is when we make our shows, and having been in rehearsal rooms, having directed pieces in and been an assistant director in rehearsal rooms that aren't Dead Center shows, I think the Dead Center rehearsal room is much harder to be in and involves much, much, much more technical working out of problems. It seems to me that, and I think this is massively true, it's definitely true of the Beckett's Room show, but it's perhaps even more true of the Freud show we just made in Vienna, that you start on day one with absolutely no idea how on earth you're going to achieve it and a strong nagging suspicion that you're not going to achieve it. I think all of the pieces we've made do sort of fit into that category. And there's something kind of quite honest about it, I think. Okay, with the Freud show, you know, you're introducing an audience member and we use the audience member's live testimony to create content in the show. But it's often to do with technological ambition as well and trying to test the limits of what technology can do for an audience. And it does keep one honest as a practitioner, I think, because it means you really don't waste time. You can't afford to waste
They
time.
Are usually premised around that we try and form an idea, Ben and I, we investigate it a little bit based on a rough understanding of how it might be achieved. Then we take it to somebody who knows about it, and it's only when they say, yes, you can do that, and then we pursue it. Only once, and it really broke my heart and really, really shook me in a way, creatively it was quite damaging, did we have something that just didn't work. And that was in Shakespeare's last play at the Schaubühne. We had a whole element of technology of live GPS tracking on all the characters that was going to monitor them. And we had been told, absolutely, this is on us, it's not on this coder. But we had been told that it's possible, but this coder did qualify, but it's very unreliable. And it's very hard to achieve. He says, we might get it to a position where this works, but it might actually fail. And then what? And we had too many eggs in that basket. Just go, no, it will. And so we had, that was one time where a planned technological element just absolutely had to be cut at the 11th hour from a show. And the show quickly reconceived to work without it. And we got to a performance that there was other things going on. So we kind of got over the line, but it was a big, it gave me a fright, you know, it gave me a fright to pursue something so far and then it doesn't work, you know? So
it
made me nervous for a while afterwards, but hopefully we've got our ambition back.
I do want to ask you a few more questions to do with this sort of work with the audience and how that journey has changed through the different shows. As in, you know, you've just mentioned casting the audience at the beginning of Lippi. We talked about the audience becoming ghosts in Hamlet. You mentioned the audience. Is it the audience that comes on stage as part of the Freud play? A member of the audience comes on stage.
Yes.
And of course, that also happens in Chekhov's first play, that you have an audience member kind of playing the protagonist. And I guess linked to that might be this element of sound in Chekhov's first play and the decision to use headphones.
Well, that came from the director's commentary and how that would function. That was the sort of base. And then we were unpacking what possibilities does that offer. And that works on a sort of very simple level. The resonance of a voice in your head being the voice of your consciousness and how that would be operating. And then it's just sort of a disembodied voice in that way, which you've met, what you've seen me, but then I go away and then it sort of takes on a life of its own and has a different quality as it turns against itself and distorts. Then you realize, you have an opportunity for giving an audience member direction through this special set, that one seat has this special set of headphones. Mm-hmm. Then the second half where all the characters lose their voices in this way and they become fractured and disembodied. You have different textures and different ways in which you can tell the story.
Mm. I'm just really interested in that audience perspective specifically in relation to Chekhov's first play, regarding that audience member who gets selected to... I'm not going to ask you to give away all your secrets and so on, but I'm just interested in the way in which that moment in the play works. And do they know from the start that they will be doing this part? How does...
Yeah, we can give some of it away because it's not... It's okay. It's part of the part of the process of it. We ask somebody in the bar beforehand or the queue. We frame it in such a way, all we do is we worked it out what the language is. Again, because it's really part of the performance, how you approach somebody, and you have to use the right language so that you get the right person. And the right person really just means that you have not forced somebody to do it. That's mm-hmm. all it means. It's no right person in terms of how the result is. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It can be however they are is correct. That's right. But you don't want to find yourself in a situation where somebody wishes they weren't there because it's not interesting to watch suffering, you know. And so we find a language in which you make it clear the coordinates of what would be involved, but also you don't want to say anything of the deep of the content because you do want it to be a pure experience for them and for the audience to see this organic event unfold. Yeah. So we find the right language, and if they agree, a lot of people say no, and then we find somebody, and if they agree, we take them to the seat. So they sit in that particular seat. Mm-hmm. We swap their ticket, and the ticket is in a very particular, and that and we put the I put the jacket on them, I put their headphones on them. Ben does a quick 1-2 because Ben does the instructions for them. And we just make sure they know, and we just say that's how it will work. Other than that, you don't need to know anything. Good luck. Have a wonderful show. See you at the end. That's it. So we have very minimal contact, and then it's left. The Freud show is even more extremely unprepared. We just invite everybody in the audience to stand up at one, but there's the actress dressed as Freud. She dresses as Freud. She says she's going to analyze somebody's dream. She invites everybody to stand up. She then explains that psychoanalysis begins with Freud listening to women's dreams. So tonight, to honor that, we want to hear let a woman speak. So can all the men sit down? And it says, right, ladies, I would like to hear your dreams, you know? So I'd like one of you to come on stage and lie on this couch. Thank you. And then Freud sits in the chair and waits. And obviously the room is confused and unsure. And eventually, organically, that was our bet. Our bet was just in the auditorium of the Academy Theatre, 500, somebody will come up. Of course, as in the Chekhov play, a lot of the time, a lot of the audience think it's a plant. Of course, there's no really escaping that. But you try and fashion something whereby it works anyway. You know, it's still curious, even if I think it's always better if you know it's really the beauty of an unprepared audience member. But it's still a coherent evening if you think it's a plot, even albeit a slightly less theatrically thrilling one.
For me, strictly speaking, it's live or shoot myself. That's why I always carry a loaded pistol.
I wasn't always like this.
In fact, has anyone seen my gun?
I had ambitions once. For new forms of theatre.
These big houses make me uncomfortable. All this wealth and opulence. The Platonov I knew would never have come here.
Connect to audiences in a new way.
Anna, have you seen my gun?
Remind us that we're alive.
You can ask him about his failed ideals yourself once he gets here. All of you can.
That's what I was saying before. Your generation don't hold on to anything. You've let go of ideals. Platonov more than anyone.
I'm going to shoot the next person who mentions Platonov.
Maybe one of you should have been Platonov. That would have been good.
I actually saw Platonov at the theater last night. Saw this musical. Very funny.
I doubt there was anything funny about it.
A real person from the audience.
You ought to stop going to see play acting and take a look at your own reality. What a boring life you lead. And what uninteresting things you all talk about.
The real world on stage.
There's some truth in that.
Instead of this.
When Platonov gets here, we'll really start talking. We'll say what we really mean.
This.
I remember at the university I'd stay up all night talking with Platonov. He was somebody.
Aren't I somebody?
They're frauds. Like me.
Do we matter? I have a feeling we don't anymore.
You can't hang the expectations of the whole evening on one person. It doesn't make sense. We're having a good enough time without him, aren't we? Aren't we?
Can we stop this?
I keep expecting something to happen. It's as if the house is going to fall down around our ears or something.
No one will remember us. That's fate. There's nothing you can do about it. Things that seem important to us. Serious and significant things. The time will come when they'll all be forgotten. Or they won't seem important anymore. In time, perhaps, this life of ours, the one we're so proud of, will seem strange, stupid, messy.
I've lost the gun.
Yes, the gun. Where did I put it? Yes, here it is. At least let me explain one thing right. Chekhov once said that if in the first act you put a gun on stage, then in the last act, it must be fired. Otherwise, you don't put it there. But if you fire it in the first act, you're fucked.
We talked a lot about this when we're making a Chekhov show about were there strategies we could employ to make it 100% clear to the audience what was going on. With the Chekhov piece, we didn't seem to be within the sort of metaphysics of the show we'd made that we could tell the audience in any way, because there is no absolute authority in that show, because Bush's character is sort of talking with authority of the audience, but that's being undermined because that's, you know. So, and also B, I think when it really works, an audience are hopefully wondering to themselves all the time, is that a real person? No, it can't be. Oh, but look at the way they're doing that dancing. But no, it can't be. But no, yeah.
And then that chimes. The psychology is, do I know what I'm doing or do I not know what I'm doing? You know, and that sort of existential psychology is at the heart of the Chekhovian sort of character in that sense. And then that's fine that the audience, you're using that strategy, that question, is that a plant or is that not, is the same. Is this rehearsed or do they not know what they're doing?
Mm-hmm.
Which becomes the same existential question, you know?
Yeah, because that idea in that show did come, I think probably did sort of, I can't remember how it originated, but it definitely wasn't unconnected to the text of Chekhov's piece. And to a sort of simple reading of this idea of a central character who literally just say to people, I'm not who you think I am. You know, it does seem to represent this blank space.
We are ostensibly talking about, you know, sound in your work, but actually I am really interested in this question of what the authorship model there is, how we make theatre, how we think about making theatre, how we go in step with the time and so on and so forth. What we've been talking about is this idea that you are very conscious of how authority in theatre might function, and you are sort of concerned with undermining it or questioning the ethics of it. And then I've just realized, just talking to you, that we are talking about these shows that we are referring to as the Proust show and the Chekhov show and the Beckett show and the, you know, and the Wittgenstein show is coming up as well. I mean, how does that notion of authority of Western, you know, white
canon,
male often. Yeah,
male.
And the canon, yeah.
Yeah.
work with how do you kind of what,
well I hope like a lot of people we prefer, you know, the way we prefer men is dead, you know, that my favorite kind of man is a dead man. It's a question for us a little bit, and you know, we wonder if it's a failing, so it's something we keep in mind for our future work. We try to pick these canon writers, but and then because that's the opportunity, you're sort of taking on figure of the establishment in a way and trying to create a democratic relationship with it, with the thinking involved and with the writing involved, by telling the stories anew and afresh and in a different way. So I think you're just trying to democratize authority in a way. So that's it. At the same time, though, but it's not safeguarded from the criticism of, well, there's another way you could do that. Just turn your back on it in its entirety. Well, but, and I agree also, with that as well. So.
Because also I think I'd maybe go a bit further, maybe, and I think I'm just thinking as soon as I say it, because that argument of democratizing access to, let's say, Chekhov is also the argument that is made for doing a big old boring Chekhov play at the National Theatre. I'm not saying that that happens. I'm just, you know, using that as a stand-in. Whereas
you've been covering your ass a lot, Ben. In this conversation, you keep saying not. Well, I'm not saying that.
No, you're covering your ass. But you know, that idea of democratizing, as you were saying that reminds me of what is often said behind some of the most deadly and kind of horrific dead ends in theatre. You know, that I just want to open up access to this to a new generation, because, and I know that's not what you meant, but I wonder if sometimes we've been able to, certainly I'm thinking with the Chekhov piece, this is true, with Hamlet in regards to Shakespeare, I think this is true. I think with the Freud piece, this is true as well, that if you do take on something that is, Freud's a good example, because Freud for the Viennese is kind of Shakespeare. You know, if you do take on something that has such large cultural capital and is so, then you can undermine it. I don't think we make fun of Chekhov in the piece, but we definitely do make fun of a kind of way of interpreting Chekhov. And we definitely give someone an excuse to go, yeah, Chekhov's shit. Like,
As a distinguishing point, so we say, let's say the traditional production of a Chekhov play says, okay, we're doing this with somebody famous from the telly so that the young kids come and see it. And we're actually going to make this more accessible. But what you're doing in that process, while you do that, you're preserving the traditional view and reception of the work. You're just trying to make more people come to that traditional mode of reception. There is a way you should understand Chekhov, and we're just going to try and get more people to see that way. Whereas I hope what we're trying to do is sort of celebrate misreading and misunderstanding.
Right.
To say that misreading and misunderstanding is really as important as understanding a thing might be.
Yeah.
So it's a sort of a polyphony of readings, you know, and a polyphony of interpretation, you know, and so it becomes much more unruly than bringing everybody to the same church, you know.
It's very stimulating anyway to think about it in relation to your work. And I think in any case, what you do with the classics is not something that many other companies in the English-speaking world are doing. There could be a whole other conversation about interpretation, but I should probably stop at this point. Sure. Thank you so much. I mean, it's just been really interesting talking to both of you.
You've been listening to Lend Me Your Ears, presented by Duška Radosavljević, curated by Flora Petrolo, and produced by Tim Bano. The Lend Me Your Ears podcast is part of Oral Dramaturgies, an AHRC leadership fellowship held by Duška Radosavljević at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama.